Dr. Arbogast.
Thank you. So I have to admit I don't know too much about the math club, so it's good to see so many people here. So, of course, I'm in the Department of Mathematics, but also in the Center for Subsurface Modeling of the Institute for Computational Engineering and Sciences. So this is an institute that specializes in solving problems, looking at modeling of real-world systems and trying to model them computationally so that you can answer questions about them. So what we do is model fluid flows underground and try to allow people to answer questions about those fluids. The talk today would be more in line with, say, a hydrologist who is out in the field and there is a contamination somewhere in the field. So maybe a leaking storage tank and the fluids have flowed through the ground. And so these techniques would be able to simulate that on the computer and allow them to understand where it might be going, if they intervened in some way, what if the effects might be. And yes, trying to find it back the other way, just figure out who's responsible. The lawyers always get involved in these things. So that's a little bit of the background. So this might be a little different talk than is usual in here. It's very applied and very computational. So I have a collaborator in Taiwan and a former graduate student who's now working in Houston in one of the petroleum service companies, actually. So I want to begin with talking about the underlying differential equation, because it's important to understand what equation is governing the system, so we understand the system. So it's all based on conservation. So if xi is some conserved quantity, in our case perhaps it is the concentration of carbon tetrachloride, say. So it's the mass of this contaminant per volume. So the density. And if you take that quantity and integrate it over some region of space, you have the total mass in that region. And then if you take the time derivative of that, of course, it's the change. So why does it change? Well, it changes in this context for two reasons. One is easy to explain. The outside world interacts with that volume. So you take some of the contaminant away or you leak some in. So we represent that by an external source or sink of fluid, which has the units of the amount of mass per volume that comes in per time. So that would have to be integrated over the region. So there is the external world. But, of course, you could have flow coming across the boundary of that region. So you have to have a fluid velocity, describing how fast these particles are moving, of the bulk fluid. So the water and the contaminant together. If you multiply by xi times that, you have the flux. It's the mass per area per time. So if you look at a little boundary piece, a little bit of area, you have some velocity of fluid going through it, and it takes along with it some of the mass, But of course, you have to decompose it into the part that's normal and the part that's perpendicular, that's parallel. The part that's parallel doesn't actually leave the domain, only the part that's normal. So we take the normal component, multiply by xi, and integrate over the boundary. So that's pretty much the physics of any conservation principle, conservation of the contaminant. Then the mathematics takes over. So whenever you have an integral over a boundary of the normal component of a vector, of course, we have the divergence theorem. And so we can rewrite this quantity as the divergence of the vector field. And now we see this change in mass. I guess I've brought the derivative inside. The change in mass over this region is given by two integrals over the region. Of course, the region is arbitrary. So you can prove, at least if these quantities are smooth enough, then in fact they have to hold pointwise. So there's our differential equation of conservation. And it actually comes up in a lot of contexts. But in our transport problem of an incompressible fluid, I'll usually call this thing a tracer. The carbon tetrachloride, the contaminant, or whatever you care about. So the tracer flowing miscibly in another fluid within an incompressible medium. So everything will be incompressible here. The bulk fluid itself, the tracer in the water, say, also satisfies a conservation principle. The quantity we're trying to preserve is the overall mass density. Now, there's an extra little term there, phi. Phi is what we call the porosity. Oh, it's written there. It is the ratio of pore volume to bulk volume in a porous medium. So when I first got into this area, I thought that when they drilled for oil, they found a big pool of oil and brought it up. Well, that's nothing close to correct. It's more like the beach, where you pour water in the sand and it goes into the sand. So there's all this little space between the rock particles. And that's where the fluids are when you're looking at subsurface flows. Yes?
Is fluid velocity the same as the viscosity of the substance?
No. No. And I'll get to viscosity much later. Okay. But it's the velocity of the particles. It's related to the viscosity. We'll see it later. But there's a small correction because we're not dealing with empty space. We're dealing with space that's filled with a lot of rock particles. So we have to multiply by that factor. So any guesses as to what kind of number that would be for a rock? Yeah, well, it varies, of course, from rock to rock, of course. But typical rocks might be 20% empty. Sandstones, you can see the spaces in sandstones. They might be 50 to 60% porous. So there's actually a lot of space, but we have to make that small correction. So this is the mass per unit, actually, pore volume. And so here's the equation. And we rewrite that this way because it's incompressible, so the density doesn't change. And we write U for let's see here. So, we can divide by rho because it's constant. And we can correct for the phi. So we rewrite it this way. So this velocity is not actually the velocity of the particles. It's the apparent velocity of the fluid. So if you think about it, if these are little rock grains, the velocity is only inside of these little pieces. It's quite large, but if you kind of take the average over it all, it's a little slower. So the velocity I'm talking about is this number less than 1 times that, accounting for the fact that if I don't pay too much attention to the details of this picture underground, then I will get the overall flow. So, by the way, how long should I go?
About 6.
Okay. And then the contaminant or tracer itself is going to satisfy this type of equation, where now the conserved quantity is the porosity times the concentration of this tracer. So this time, it will change with time. And the external source, actually, you should realize, this one is just giving you bulk fluid. So you have to tell me how much bulk fluid is injected or taken out. But when I'm taking out the contaminant, I can't just choose what I want to take out. I have to take out what's there. So it's C. And when I inject it, I have to tell you how much I injected. So hopefully that's zero, but depends on the application. Okay, so those are the equations. And they're all based on conservation. So when we look at a numerical method to approximate this differential equation, we like to use what are called locally conservative methods. So a locally conservative method is one for which this approximate solution will satisfy the conservation principle, but not point-wise, rather over certain discrete regions. So usually you take your domain, whatever your domain looks like, and you divide it into small pieces, some kind of mesh. And so we'd want it to hold over each mesh. That was a check mark. Okay. Over each little piece. So if I, they're called elements, by the way, so that's why I use E. So we want the conservation principle of the bulk fluid to satisfy that equation. And there are lots of methods that we can use to solve that problem. The other equation, though, if we were going to be compatible with this one, we would have to conserve things over the same element. So, if you use what are called fixed grid methods, then you have no trouble here. You just use the same grid for the two methods. But I'm going to describe what are called characteristic methods, or Lagrangian methods, where we look at the fluid by following along the fluid particles. So you follow along with the particles. So in that case, we have to use more general space-time regions. So use script E4. And so there's a real question here. Is there some kind of numerical incompatibility if I do this? So I solve this equation using one method, I solve this equation using a second method. They're both sort of locally conservative, but maybe they're not conservative in a consistent way. And so I could lose some of my contaminant in the computer. That's kind of a problem with carbon tetrachloride, because 10 to the minus 9 parts per billion, you know, one part per billion is toxic. So you have to keep these things very carefully. Well, the tracer mass was this equation over this space-time region. the ambient fluid also satisfies the conservation principle, the water. Its concentration is 1 minus C, so you just put 1 minus C in there. So this should be satisfied if we're consistent. Both fluids should be conserved. But the red here is actually the equation above, so if you cancel that, you're left with my other equation, but it needs to be conserved over this space-time region, not over this other element that I was using. So it looks like there's an incompatibility. If you look more carefully, there are what are called mixed finite element methods, which I like to use. They actually satisfy this condition point-wise for the approximate solution. Well, up to the fact that I have to take a projection of the source term. But aside from that minor point, which affects things, but we satisfy the conservation point-wise. So, of course, we satisfy it over any region, and it looks like there's no incompatibility. I will show you that there's a subtle incompatibility. And it has to do with the way in which this gets implemented. Because I haven't actually told you how you would do that yet. So that's the next thing, is to start looking at how we would approximate these methods. So the first thing you need to realize about this differential equation is that there is a special path in it. That path describes the path the particles actually travel on. It's given by solving the derivative of the path in time is the velocity. The particle velocity, u divided by phi. So this is the differential equation. Here's an initial condition for the lower time level. Here's the picture. Space, time, start here. Solve the differential equation, you trace out the particle path. Okay? The concentration is constant on this space-time path because it's actually the motion of the particles. You just take the derivative of the concentration on that path, use the chain rule, partial in time, this is the partial in space. So I have to take a gradient, dot it into the derivative of that path. But that's u over phi. Factor out the 1 over phi. There's my equation. That's equal to 0. I think I've made an assumption the divergence of u is 0. But it is most places because you have wells. The q only shows up when you have a well. So in between the wells. Okay, so this is actually the Lagrangian coordinate, because I'm following along the path. So we're going to be doing that. But we're going to do it backwards in time. I know it seems a little odd, but it works out to be more convenient to start at the advanced time level and track backward in time. So this is a check instead of a hat going down. But it has the same properties. So, but you solve a backward differential equation with a final condition. So this idea was used in the, well, let's see, 30 years ago now. The idea was to use a finite difference approximation of the characteristic derivative. So the characteristic derivative is, as I pointed out, it's this expression. But this characteristic derivative is c at the point minus c at the previous point along the streamline divided by delta t. So this and that should really be the same. So this should be, well, 0 most of the time. Once in a while it's equal to the source. So if that was zero, no external stuff going on, the concentration there would be the concentration here, like it's supposed to be. Okay, so there are some problems with this method. Because it's based on points, it violates all of the conservation principles. You don't really understand what's going on in between the points. So, to obtain mass conservation, it was about 20 years ago that people realized that you should trace regions rather than points. And so, here's the picture. Here's a grid element. I trace it backward in time to its traceback region and tracing out the space-time region. See, all the mass here simply ends up there. So if this is my grid, you see why it's more convenient to go backward. I'll just figure out what goes here by going back. So these are the formal definitions of those in terms of the characteristic, but the picture is what it is. So let's go back to our equation. We're going to integrate in space-time over this region. The equation is actually a divergence. It's a space-time divergence. The space part here and the time part here. So, of course, we have the divergence theorem again, but now in space and time. So, I don't know, if you're a physicist, maybe you think of space and time as different, but mathematician, who cares, right? It's just an independent variable. So, the divergence theorem works. Boundary of that space-time set, and here's my normal. So you have to kind of look at it. Here I've drawn the picture again. I've assumed this is the boundary of the domain. We might cut the boundary of the domain. The top part of the boundary, the normal is positive time. So I only get the time part, which is the phi, at the advanced time level n plus 1. At the bottom, I get the E check at the and now the normal is time, but negative time. And on the side, the particles are traveling this way, the normal is that way, that derivative is zero, that normal component is zero. Except if you cut the boundary. So I do have the boundary if you happen to cut it. So it's all based on this idea, right? All of the particles are just traveling straight up, so nothing goes across. So this is a special region where you don't have any flow through the boundary in some sense. So the local mass constraint then is that the total amount of mass at E is the total amount of mass that was in E check plus anything from the outside world or the outside the boundary. You have a similar mass constraint for the bulk fluid itself. The equation was divergence U is Q. Of course, this is zero. So again, it looks like a divergence. It looks like a divergence with C equal to 1. Let me go back. It's the same equation with C equal 1, because that would go away, U, and, well, that would be just Q. So we have the same kind of constraint. Okay, I mean, there's two fluids, right? There's the water and the contaminant. They both have to be conserved. And so they both satisfy a similar equation. I'm going to use this notation for what's called pore volume. It's the integral with phi. so we ignore the rock. So you can rewrite this as the pore volume, the amount of space you have in E, is the amount of space you had earlier, plus any amount of mass you got from the external world. It's incompressible, so we can't scrunch it together. Okay. So, some 20 years ago, we put this together to define a method that approximates the concentration at the advanced time level over the element. You multiply it by the space that you have. That's the fluid that you had earlier in time over this traceback region, plus accounting for the external world. So if you look at it in multiple dimensions here, you would look at this, for example. You'd trace it back in time. The fluid there actually moved to here because there's some kind of velocity field in here. So the average amount of fluid would be whatever you came up with here plus the other stuff. So it does take a little bit of work because my mesh isn't going to align with that. So you have to do a bunch of integrations in there. But more seriously, this shape is curved. And I've illustrated it here. And really, you know, you can't deal with that because I can't track every infinite number of points. I can track, say, the corners and the midpoints, and I can connect them with lines. That's fine. So this practical implementation would require that I get E tilde rather than E check. And they don't have the same volume in general. So there's a nice way of thinking of this. What I'm really doing is just think of getting the triangle instead. How did I get that triangle? Well, think of it as the exact tracing back of this line to that line, but I had to modify the velocity to do that. I'd perturb it a little bit, because the real velocity would go to the curve, so it's a slightly different velocity. So it's as if I'm using the wrong velocity. Pretty close. It's accurate, but it's slightly wrong. Because it's slightly wrong, it doesn't satisfy the conservation principle over the same region. This is the subtle incompatibility that we have. This volume is incorrect. In essence, I'm not using the velocity field that I calculated. I'm actually using a slightly perturbed one because I can't follow every point. The volume error can be quite large. So we did an example with a well, and we found the error was 200%. So it's twice as big as it was supposed to be here, and 10% too small in a bunch of places. So it can be quite significant, especially near wells. Getting the wrong volume is very important because you get densities wrong. Densities control reaction dynamics, and so your reactions would all be screwed up. You don't get the right volume. So how do we fix this? Well, we came up with a scheme that is efficient. The idea is pretty simple. We traced to these points. We're just going to move them a little bit until the region has the right volume. So, you know, as a mathematician, you don't like to ever say a little bit, because that isn't well defined. So we have to go through a full algorithm to define exactly what it means to perturb those points. But if you just hold off on what that means, then you correct the volume in this method, and you can get then both a conservation of the mass of the tracer, because this is the equation that conserves the mass. And also now we're conserving the volume, which means we're conserving the mass of the other fluid, the bulk fluid, the water. So we conserve them both consistently. And here's a little example that you have to be careful, because you can introduce systematic bias into the flow field if you don't perturb these points in a careful way. So here was an example of our first attempt to implement this idea. And somehow we moved these points incorrectly, and so it created a little nose. Oh, I'm sorry, this is the correct solution, and this is what we ended up with. We somehow channeled the flow together because we just kind of moved it around improperly. So you have to really understand the equation and the fact that it really does represent transport. There's a couple of ideas. I'm going to skip a lot of this because it's fairly technical and not that interesting. But I will mention the first key idea was to deal with the wells directly, because that's where most of the error comes from. If you have an injection well, where I'm injecting fluid into the domain through this well, when I trace, I go backwards. So if I have an element out here, it gets sucked into the well. And it's really tiny, and it's very hard to even see. So that doesn't work very well. It's very hard to deal with that. So some people came up with the idea of tracing out the way you would normally think you would trace. So you do have to do that near wells. The external boundaries, inflow boundaries, are similar to that. So here's a picture of it. Here's my well. It's injecting fluid over the blue region, although it's been approximated by a polygon. I have to make sure that the size of that region is correct based on the amount of fluid I injected. So we do have to adjust that until we have the volume balance. So we're actually affecting the right amount. I'll explain how we move the points next. This guy, this element, no problem. He's completely dominated by what happens at the well. This guy is cut. Some of his fluid came from the well. Some of his fluid came from already inside the domain. So we just have to account for this. So that's the next part, is how we correct and make sure this volume, the green part, is the same volume as that part. Or in general, if you don't cut. So the key idea was that you need to adjust the points in the direction of the flow. I mean, it's moving in a certain direction. Physically, it has to keep moving in that direction. So instead of solving the traceback equation all the way back to time tn, we'll just change this time a little bit. So here's the picture. If instead of going all the way back on the blue, I go back to here, I ended up moving the point a little bit forward. Or a little backward if I go further. So that's the way to do it. And that keeps it physically consistent with the flow field. And so now it's perturbed a little bit. Okay, still haven't fully defined it, but that at least keeps you doing the physically correct thing. And the way you actually correct all the volume in the domain, so you've got, say, a rectangular grid, and you traced it back to here. So these are the shapes that are distorted, the trace back shapes. These points have all been adjusted, so the volume here, the volume there, the volume there are all correct. Look at the next layer, the flow is that way. So I guess the grid was over here and it came back this way. But anyway, we look at the next layer. And it's important not to adjust sort of piece by piece, because if you did that, you're basically taking your error here and kind of pushing it to your neighbor. And then that guy pushes his error to the neighbor, and the next neighbor, and the next neighbor. And you end up with all the error at the end, which adds up, of course. Okay, so you can't quite do that. So you have to sort of take a layer, this entire line in the domain, all together, let it go forward or backward in time until the volume here is correct. And then we'll sort of spread it out. We've got a little bit of error in this region, but we'll correct by moving the midpoints until each individual one is correct. Then go to the next layer. So you have to use this kind of layering process, but if you notice, it's not an iterative technique, it's very direct. You just have to do this once to adjust that line and then adjust each individual piece. That's actually on the next slide. The midpoint can be moved perpendicular to the line joining them. So it's a fast, direct algorithm. By the way, why do we take orthogonal? No, it's the maximum change. Yeah, it's so mathematics, right? You could do anything, but that one is the maximum change. The minimal change in the point causes the maximal change in the volume. So again, perturb the points just a little. Okay, so let me show you that it works and that it's important. Here's the viscosity. The velocity for subsurface applications is proportional to the gradient of the pressure of the fluid. The constants are the permeability, how easy it is to flow through the rock, divided by the viscosity, how hard it is for the fluid to flow. So we add that equation to the set of equations we had, and we can solve the problem. So here's an example of a nuclear contamination. And this coefficient K, this permeability, it represents how easy it is to flow through rock. So they're small numbers, real small numbers. But one rock is very different from another rock. So they vary a lot. They're highly heterogeneous. What you're looking at here is a variation in the rock properties of 10 to the fifth, 100,000, factor of 100,000 over small distances. This actually makes it quite hard and gives you a very complicated flow field. We have some flow coming across and we're injecting, well, let's say there's a leak here. So a leak of some radioactive contaminant here. This is the picture I showed you before of the severe volume errors. Once it's been adjusted, the volume errors are rounding error. There's no actual improper volume anymore. And this is what happens. So this is the method I've been describing. You get a nice plume. The maximum concentration that is injected is this blue, light blue. And you see you never go above that. This is the uncorrected method. This is the method where I don't correct the volume. You can see I go way above what I should. There's no loss of mass between this picture and that picture. What's happening is you get the wrong volumes. So I'm showing you concentration, which is the density. So it involves the volume. So the volume is too small, so the density is too large. The differential equation satisfies a maximum principle. You cannot have a solution that has a value bigger than 1 e to the minus 5 under the conditions that I'm doing this simulation. But this one shows it because of the incorrect volume. So let's look at some more issues. There are other ways to solve these problems that involve fixed grids. So you don't follow the flow at all. So you just use a fixed grid, and based upon what you see around here, you update the value of the grid directly. So these methods generally have what's called a CFL restriction, because you don't want fluid to flow, say, from this element all the way to here through an element. It's very difficult to understand that full process. It's not so bad if it goes one cell, because then I just have to understand how it goes across this line. If it's from here all through that to here, then I have to understand how this guy affected it and how everything affected everything else. So you generally can't take a very large time step. You have to limit it by the size of the grid divided by the velocity. That means information can't travel more than a grid cell. There's a popular method called Godunov's method that is known to be accurate, satisfies the CFL condition. If you violate it, the method is unstable. What that means is errors build up and you very rapidly get nonsense for your solution. But I'll compare our method to the Godunov method. This is on a 64 by 64 grid. This one uses a time step that is the CFL maximum you can use. Gives a nice answer. Now the maximum is this somewhat darker blue. You never go above it. It's a perfect method. Our method uses a time step of 3 years, five times the CFL limit. Why? Because we don't care if you cross several cells, because we're following the flow. You notice something else. This is spread compared to this. I'll show you the true solution is very sharp. But for now, let me just say, this is evidence of what's called numerical diffusion. The true solution isn't spreading like that, but the numerical one does. And it's because you have to take so many steps, and every time you take a step, you make a little bit of error, and they tend to build up and cause it to spread. Okay. So the one step, one method took 51 steps, the other took 10. Let's refine the grid to get a more accurate answer, 128 by 128. You can see it's sharpening up, and you can see this one is still sharper. And now we're taking 7 times the CFL, so many fewer steps, 205 versus 30, and 256 by 256, they're real sharp now. But that one is better, and that one is almost 14 times. So 820 steps versus 60. So you're getting the answer by doing a lot fewer time steps. Of course, I have to admit, each step is a lot of work. So computationally, we'll have to think about that. But the fact that we take fewer steps means we have much less spreading. And that's really important for a lot of problems. And here is one more example. Very complicated permeability generates a very complicated flow field. Inject here, produce up there. It goes in some wild way. If you don't correct the volume, it's horrible. If you correct the volume, it's beautiful. Now, maybe I should go on. So here's the one from the picture. So you start with some fluid in the middle. Your flow field is just vortices. This is a problem that you would use to study mixing, because you can start to see it's mixing, right? But very nice and sharp, very beautiful contours for this mixing. If you want to study mixing, you let it go for a long, long time. So here it's gone a long time. It's really mixed. On this, so this is a 256 by 256 grid. That one's a little sharper. This side is uncorrected, and this side is corrected. I wouldn't have guessed this. Just by correcting the volume, moving the points where they weren't supposed to be in the first place, but achieving this volume balance, it actually strongly improved the solution because there's so much less spreading. And here where you get a little more resolution, you can really see it. So it really makes a big difference. If you understand the problem, the physics, and you work hard to maintain that in the numerical method. So we can prove a lot of things about this scheme. It's really kind of cute because it's all differential equations and everything, but it turns out that you can look at it algebraically. If you look at it algebraically, it's actually a matrix problem. The new concentration is a combination of the old concentrations. And this guy's a matrix, and that matrix has entries. Where'd they go? Here they are. This is the entry of the matrix. It's the, so the E, F. So E and F are grid cells. It's the size of the grid cell E on the denominator, and then it's the intersection of the F cell with the trace back of E. So that's what it ends up being. That matrix has a lot of nice properties. Its entries are positive. The row sums are 1. Well, in general, they could be less than or equal to 1, but only if you correct the volume. So if you don't correct the volume, this could be bigger than 1, and that causes problems. But you maintain this row sum property. The matrix doesn't increase the little infinity norm of a vector. That has to do with overshooting. So when I showed you those pictures where we have the maximum and no bigger, that's because of this property. You can't increase the maximum. So you can prove that purely algebraically. And then you have a theorems. You can't have overshoots or undershoots because of that property. I'll go through this fast. It's late in the day. You have stability. this is my method, and you slightly perturb the method, rounding error, let's say, because you're always going to have some rounding error, then you can prove that the two solutions stay close to each other. So the difference between them, where is it here, the maximum difference between them, is controlled by how different they were at the beginning and how different they were at each step. So that's nice. So rounding error is never going to build up and cause a problem. And this is the result that we're quite proud of, proving the convergence of the scheme. If you look at the difference between the true solution and the approximate solution, measure it in what's called L1, so the integral of the difference. It's bounded by the size of your grid divided by the square root of your delta t. Now, people who know something about these, oh, and there's also this term, delta t to the r. R is the order of how you solve for the characteristics. So in theory, I can do that as accurately as I want. So R could go to infinity, and delta t being small would go away. So this is kind of weird, because it says you want to take delta t to be large, because if I take it to be large, this term is smaller. But usually you think you want to take a small delta t, so you're accurate. But no, this is correct, because we're following the flow accurately. In fact, the farther we go back, the better we are, because one step is exact, right? So we take many steps because other processes are going on with it, but in point of fact, one step would be better. There is no CFL constraint. You can take as big a time step as you want. And the optimal choice when R is 1 is to take your delta t to be h to the 2/3, I think. Yeah, 2/3. And the error will be h to the 2/3. Explicit methods, the best you can do is h to the 1/2. So these are better than that. And we actually tested it on some examples. So the numerical solution was solved compared to a fine solution, which is thought of as exact. And the claim was this is h to the 2/3, right? So we can compute this. We can divide by our mesh parameter, and we can see if that's a constant. So this is the ratio. So we looked at that ratio in our simulations. So here is h, very different values of h. Here are different values of delta t with that correct scaling. I think c was 1 here, but I don't quite remember. And then here is the error. So the error is getting smaller, as you can see, as you get more refined. But that ratio should be bounded, should be constant. Well, actually, here it's getting smaller. So maybe it's a little better. We're not quite sure, but we tried a second example where we just took nothing inside, injected 1, so there's a step function. Should be 1 and then 0. And that one, if you check that constant, that ratio, it is actually bounded. So that is the best you can do. Since here's an example, it shows you hit that. Okay. And then finally, I'll close with this brief application to nuclear waste disposal. So this was a problem defined by the French Nuclear Regulatory Agency as a test problem. You have a repository of nuclear materials here, underground storage, waste dump, if you will, but it's leaking. So of course you have to examine the possibilities of leakage and what would happen. So we have different kinds of rock. Dogger is some kind of rock, I guess. Clay, limestone, marl, I guess, is another kind of rock. So we have lots of clays and limestones in Texas, though. So various boundary conditions and so on. There are actually a few additional things going on. You have some reaction terms, and you have some diffusion, physical diffusion going on. But the mesh, rectangular, it's refining the repository here. This is the traceback mesh. We cheated a little bit. We don't quite get it proper here. If you take this thing and trace it back, right, it could kind of trace back to that, self-intersecting. Now, the real shape doesn't. The real shape is probably something, you know, weird like that. But unless I took more points, I wouldn't know. So that's something we could do, of course. We could simply take more points. But that's a lot of effort in the code, so we just took that. The pressure on the top, the speed of the fluid on the bottom, they're not very interesting. This is interesting. The concentration of the iodine waste. So after 100 years... it's leaking a little bit. This is the Godunov, which we should accept as being correct. And our method, very similar. But here you start to see a problem. The Godunov method, after 250,000 years, time step of 100 years, you're seeing a lot of numerical diffusion. So it's predicting you have iodine very far away, even though you really shouldn't. Because this one doesn't have nearly the same diffusion. So you're getting much better result. And by the way, we took a time step of 25 times that one. And then later, of course, it does get there. But took more like 300,000 years to get there. And in the end, they look kind of similar. You can kind of see this ugly yellow color here. It's spread out more than it should. But okay, so this example, we were actually faster. The Godunov method took 67 seconds, and our method took 40 seconds. So we were like 64% of the time. So if you have a long enough problem, it's worth doing the extra work. But of course, the difference between these two is invaluable. You'd pay a lot more to get this quality answer anyway, because you can't afford to make that mistake in your predictions. So, summary. Fully conservative method. We conserve the mass of the tracer, but also the bulk volume through this local point adjustment. It's some kind of algebraic method if you want to view it that way, and because of that you can prove it doesn't have overshoots or undershoots. And has a nice error estimate, does not require a CFL constraint. You can take very long time steps, and the numerical examples showed all of these properties were actually achievable. Okay. So this is probably a little different style of talk than you're used to, but a lot of mathematics comes into doing these things carefully and properly, and proving that they really do work. But a lot of computer science and everything too, to try and show that they're practical. So I hope you enjoyed. Thank you for your attention.
Has this seen a lot of adoption in this field? But it seems like it's almost too good to be true.
Well, it is still pretty expensive. So we're trying to make it computationally a little bit faster. They do use methods like this in lots of fields. It's especially useful in atmospheric studies. I mean, I happen to look underground, but above ground, they use these kinds of methods. I don't think they fully appreciate the need for volume balance. The one thing that limits the method is that the equation that I'm looking at is linear. And what I mean by that, we never get there. Am I rapping? Oh,
yeah.
Okay. So that's not good. Oh, so maybe I can wrap this way. Okay. Well, here it is. This velocity does not depend on the concentration. If it did depend on the concentration, I wouldn't know what it was to do my tracing. Right? I have to have my velocity to do my tracing. So for linear problems, this is really good. And for nonlinear problems, we're working on it. We have results. They're actually pretty impressive. I didn't show them. But you almost have to solve an optimization problem, local optimization problem, to figure out where you should come back to. So that's kind of limiting us right now to adoption. Yeah?
So the gradient of like the fluid through your boundary that you're looking at has to be has to be orthogonal to the normal of the boundary.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're correcting the polygon mesh to like adjust for error?
Well, not exactly. So it's hard to draw in one dimension. But I'll do it as best I can. So this is obviously wrong, okay? Because it's way too big. So the idea was I'm going to adjust this point. I'm going to adjust this point until it's the right size, okay? In some sense, I don't know the exact trajectory here. Doesn't matter. I've tracked correctly the red line in the wrong velocity field. But using the wrong velocity field, it is not going to flow across there. So the method works. The proof of the convergence has to do with really analyzing the difference between the real velocity and this fake one.
So you use like a limiting process to do that?
No, it's more of a constructive process. It's not really a limiting process. So we have to kind of explain constructively how these two differ and prove that they don't differ by very much.
I'm not really sure. Are most fluids incompressible, or is there a way to adapt this so you can work with?
Yeah, we can do compressible. It's just harder to explain because you have to take into account the compression. Although nonlinear compressible does have the problem I mentioned. You have to know the velocity field, or else then you have other problems. Yeah?
Does God not know you beat his men?
Well, I don't know if he's still alive. He's a famous Russian mathematician, but I think he was quite a while ago, but I don't know. Yeah.
Would there be any advantage using Gauss method over BCC method?
It is faster for most problems. It's easier to implement because there's a fixed grid. You don't have to do any of the geometry. But it's going to force you to use small time steps, and therefore you're going to have more numerical diffusion, which you don't even know how much there is. I mean, you can't control it. So I like to say these methods are especially good if you are completely intolerant of numerical diffusion. So this would be definitely preferable there, even though it may take longer to solve. Yeah.
When in your experience have you seen the scale of the simulation where it just the additional expense of the accuracy with your method really starts showing up? Is like one well is versus, I mean, I'm just trying to think of the different ways you've applied it and when it's just infeasible to use the method you just showed.
No, I think it's always always feasible to use the method if you have the linear problem. I'm not sure exactly what you're asking, but...
Well, just when you were doing the comparison of the speed with which you get the results, like when it seems like it shouldn't really matter. I mean, I couldn't imagine someone saying, look, we just can't afford that.
So right now our best results actually come from using what's called Strang splitting. So Strang is he writes textbooks. You may have seen one of his textbooks. But he's also a well-known mathematician. Can I use the eraser? And you can look at this problem. Say in two dimensions. This is my u vector dotted into the gradient. Right. So one way to approach this problem is to solve this problem, ignoring velocity and y, and then solving this problem. And I know it looks a little funny. It looks like you're somehow missing what's going on there, but it's really not that bad, because if you think of it sort of in discrete form, you're calculating a new concentration from the old one by solving this equation, the way I did, and then you're starting from that guy and solving for the next guy. Well, this one is now using the tilde, but... So if you add these two together, this guy actually cancels. And I'm using the x velocity using what I knew before, and the y one is a little different. It's using after it moved in x. But that looks like my equation. So in other words, if you take, say, a rectangular mesh, you started with some fluid here, you'd first be moving it over here, where in y it wouldn't change. Then you'd be moving it in y to some region And now it gets really... So instead of going from here to there, doing the real 2D geometry, you go there and then up. It's pretty accurate. It's actually accurate to order delta t. And if you go here, then go here, then go here, so half here, full, and half, it's actually second order. So, but then it looks like one dimension. Now, one dimension is easy, right? Because the interval is just 2 points. So now, suddenly, it becomes really efficient. But, of course, you pay for it by having a little bit of error due to what's called the Strang splitting. You split the equation into two. Okay? So, in this sense, this is just as efficient as any other method. So we're experimenting with those kinds of ideas as well. We don't like that because it's just two 1D things, right?
Okay, so I'm just going to thank the speaker again.